And I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 827A. And Erin, could you briefly tell us about this bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 827A permits a grantor to record an affidavit stating that the grantor requests a loan modification in accordance with law and by applicable deadlines, stipulates that the failure to include the required notification form with notice of sale, failure to comply with provisions governing loan modifications, and failure to record a required affidavit of compliance with loan modification requirements are unlawful practices subjected to enforcement under unlawful trade practices law, specifies that trustees must send copies of the required affidavit to the Department of Justice, eliminates specified exceptions from compliance requirements for mortgage loan modifications, requires trustees to be residents of Oregon or have registered agents that have met specified qualification, declares emergency effective upon passage. You will find in your packet written testimony from Karen McCarthy and Gloria Olson. There is a no revenue impact statement, a minimal fiscal impact on the original measure, and this measure came from the Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection, where it had a public hearing on the 21st and 23rd and a work session on the 20th. It came with a due pass recommendation on a 3-2 vote.
Thank you, Erin. And I see that Senator Bonamici has joined us, so if you'd like to come forward, please. And welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you. It's nice to be back. Thank you, Committee. Chair Rosenbaum and Committee, I'm Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17. Thank you so much for holding this hearing today on Senate Bill 827A. As you know, Oregon is still, many of our constituents in Oregon are still faced with foreclosure and struggling with what to do when their home is in foreclosure. Last session, last full session in 2009, we worked on and passed Senate Bill 628, and I know at least a couple of you here on this committee were on the committee that last session worked so long and hard on that bill. That actually started as a mandatory mediation bill and ended up in a compromise that was involved in giving a notice to a homeowner about possible loan modification and the opportunity to meet with their lender to discuss whether they would be eligible for modification. After that bill passed, some of my colleagues here, actually on both sides of the aisle, said, well, there's no teeth in that bill. Is that really going to do anything? And so we've been watching to see what's happened with the implementation of 2009's Senate Bill 628. We made a few changes in February of 2010 that required filing the affidavit earlier than it had been required previously. And also in 2010, we added a requirement that if the homeowner was denied loan modification, that there be an explanation for that, for the denial. But since the implementation, we've talked to many consumers, and you've probably heard from constituents in your district who are in foreclosure about several issues. First of all, there's been a lot of inconsistency in the notices and in the affidavits. They're not necessarily as clear as they need to be. Many homeowners are also in what is now called a dual track. And I just noticed recently that there was federal legislation, bipartisan legislation, with Senator Snow from Maine and our Senator Merkley from Oregon to address the dual track. And what that means is that there are several loan modification programs available both through the federal government and through lenders. Homeowners will believe that they're in modification. They're either told or they understand that they're in this modification program, but at the same time, the foreclosure is moving forward, and they just don't know what to do. So that's a problem that we have identified with the implementation of 628 is homeowners not being clear about whether they're in modification or are they being foreclosed. We've also heard of sometimes there are violations of Senate Bill 628, but there really isn't a way for the homeowners to enforce those violations. So Senate Bill 827A is intended to address those problems. We understand that not everyone who is facing foreclosure will receive help, either under Senate Bill 827A or under any of the existing federal programs, loan modification programs. But for many of our constituents, there will be a way for them to stay in their home if they can get accurate information and have that opportunity to discuss loan modification with their lender. So a couple of things that Senate Bill 827A does is that for consistency in the forms and affidavits, this bill provides for DCBS rulemaking so that we can have the consistency in language for the forms and the affidavits. It also clarifies that the homeowner can file a declaration to say that they're in modification during the pendency of the modification, just so that notice is given that the consumer is working on loan modification. It also requires that the trustee file an affidavit of compliance before publishing the notice of sale, and that is to assure that the consumers actually received these important notices telling them that they can have the opportunity to apply for modification and the opportunity to meet with the lender. And under 628, the meeting can be by phone, but that opportunity to meet with a decision maker to discuss modification before they're actually faced with losing their home. And it also clarifies that violations are violations of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, our state's primary consumer protection statute. I want to emphasize that Oregon does not have judicial foreclosure. So in Oregon, their states are really mixed on this, but in Oregon, there is no court involvement in foreclosure. And so people are faced with this really critical and oftentimes devastating impact of losing their home without court involvement. So having the Unlawful Trade Practices Act as a violation, which is, in fact, our state's, as I said, primary consumer protection statute, I think is an important step when someone is faced with losing their home. So all of us have constituents who are facing foreclosure. And in fact, I mentioned this to some people the other day. I was out walking the dog, and a house just down the street from me had the people I knew had moved out, but I didn't know until I walked up and I saw the papers taped on the door, and I walked up and looked, and sure enough, their home had been foreclosed. It's happening all around us, and we recognize that Senate Bill 827A, as I explained, won't provide a solution for all of them, but it will take that important step of extending the work and strengthening the work that we did in 2009 to make sure that people will know their options and have the opportunity to pursue them before they have to leave their homes. So thank you very much for the opportunity today to talk about Senate Bill 827A. It's unfortunate that so many people are faced with foreclosure, but this is something we can do to make sure that they can pursue all of the options available to them before losing their home. So I'm happy to answer any questions. I know that there are some people here to share some personal stories and talk about the bill as well.
Thank you, Senator Bonamici. Are there any questions for the senator? Looks like you've answered them all. Okay, thank you very much for being here and for interrupting your committee. And at this point, I'm going to briefly recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 827 and open a public hearing and work session on HCR 20. And I see Senator Bates has joined us, so if you'd like to come forward.
Madam Chair, I actually tried to stop that because I think the bill you're hearing is vitally important to my district in Southern Oregon. And so I don't want to interrupt the proceedings of that for these. I can come back and do these later if it's easier for you.
And no, I think we had just gotten started, so this will be great. But thanks for your testimony. And officially.
Right.
Can we do both concurrently? Okay.
Can we do both these together?
Yeah. So I'll also open a public hearing and work session on HCR 36. And if you'd like to talk about each of these, that would be great.
I would, Madam Chair, just very quickly. And I appreciate you taking time to hear this. The bill you just heard, which I am deeply involved with also, is extremely important to Southern Oregon and to Eastern Oregon, and I suppose the rest of the state also, but Deschutes County and Jackson County have just been decimated by the foreclosure situation and loss of homes, so I'll do this quickly so you can get back to the other bill. House Concurrent Resolution Number 20 is a memoriam to William Patton. Mr. Patton was a driver of putting together and maintaining and growing the Shakespearean Festival in Ashland, Oregon. We have well over 300,000 people come to those plays now, and a good deal of that is the result of the work that Mr. Patton did. He passed away in 2011. This is a memoriam for him and his family. And I won't read through the resolution, just to say that he was a real icon in Ashland, someone everyone enjoyed and appreciated, a fine gentleman, and he worked extremely hard and made it his life work to make sure that the Shakespearean Festival became the festival that is known nationally and internationally. We have about 250,000 visitors coming to a town of 20,000 in a period of 5 or 6 months every year as a result of this theater productions. And if you have an opportunity to come down and see those productions, I think you'd really enjoy them. They are first class. They are world class. It's a joy to visit Ashland and to see these. And that's whether you're Republican, Democrat, or Independent. Okay. That is concurrent resolution number 20. Number 36 is cause concurrent resolution number 36 is a program that was just started a couple of years ago in Ashland for making food available to those who are needy. And it's a different type of program because instead of having, as most of our programs like Access and others in the area, where we pick up food from donations or have donation sites, and this is a group of people who thought there was a better and faster and more effective way of doing this. And these people started going by teams on a regular basis, almost weekly, to specific neighborhoods and getting food donated. The results of that effort are really hard to believe. The amount of food that is produced for people in need through these programs is monumental. Ashland is now a full and running program. Ashland is spreading out the talent in Phoenix and up the I-5 corridor into Medford. And Medford's just starting to do it also with the same incredible results. Several other cities in Northern California, Paradise and others, are looking at the Ashland project as a prototype for how to deliver food to the needy. And this House concurrent resolution just celebrates that and hopefully gives it some publicity so these programs can spread across the state and across the nation. I was really stunned when I first saw the numbers and the amount of food being produced by this. The door-to-door projects do two things. One, raise the food, but raise people's awareness of the needs in our community in these times of recession. So I hope you would move both these to the floor with a due pass resolution. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you, Senator Bates. And it's great, certainly, to talk again, as we did yesterday, about the Shakespeare Festival and the great work that it does, and to honor somebody who had such a remarkable career there, and then to look at the surrounding communities. As we're driving to Ashland, I know my husband always makes the same joke, which probably isn't that funny, but that we see that sign that says talent and the number of miles to Ashland and inevitably says, gee, talent is 16 miles from Ashland or however far it is. So, as I said, it's not that funny.
It is very close. And we believe everyone down there is talented.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
These. Any questions for the senator?
Sorry to interrupt your previous discussion, but thank you for taking this out of order. Thank you.
Thank you. And I guess we'll take them in the order that we heard them. So, Senator Atkinson on HCR 20.
I would move HCR 20 to the floor with a do-adopt recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved HCR 20 to the floor with a do-adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And Senator Bates, would you like to carry this on the floor? Great. And Senator Atkinson.
Do you have a work session open?
We opened both.
I would move HCR 36 to the floor with the do-adopt recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved HCR 36 to the floor with the do-adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The motion carries. And on HCR 36, it looks like Senator Bates is also the sponsor of that. Would you like to carry that as well? Great, thank you. Okay, and I will close the work session on HCR 36, and if I didn't already, I'll close it on HCR 20 as well. And I will reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 827. Looks like we have quite a few people signed up to testify, and so we'll try to hear from everybody. We'll start with In order, Angela Martin, and we have David Jones, Tim Collette, and Connie Umphress. Looks like, Tim, you traveled some distance to come to the hearing, so if you'd like to come forward, we try to take people who traveled a ways to get here. So.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Angela Martin, testifying in support of Senate Bill 827A for Economic Fairness Oregon. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to this issue. The foreclosure crisis has had a catastrophic effect on families and communities across Oregon. We've had tens of thousands of Oregon homeowners who are literally in dire straits due to the abusive practices, shoddy work, and ineffective federal oversight. And the crisis is far from over. One of the worksheets I submitted to you comes from Department of Consumer and Business Services, providing the most current numbers on the foreclosure crisis. And what we see is that we are still at near record levels. One thing the numbers don't capture is the impact on families who aren't in foreclosure yet. During a recent community meeting we had out in the Dalles, we met a woman named Catherine, and her story is becoming too common. The foreclosure crisis has literally tethered her to a community 100 miles away from the job she just secured after more than a year of unemployment. That's because, like 125,000 Oregonians, her home is underwater, and at this point her bank is not willing to work with her on a short sale. So she must drive, again, 100 miles for a job that is not an extremely high-paying job, and something that she can ill afford to do. As we've traveled across the communities, we've captured many of the stories of homeowners on video. I will make that available to you, but in consideration of the time and how many homeowners traveled here in person, I won't ask the committee's indulgence to see that today, but I will make that video interviews available to you. Since the start of the foreclosure crisis, lawmakers have taken several steps to ease the pain, and perhaps one of the most effective steps was passing laws cracking down on abusive foreclosure scams and loan modification scams. That has been very effective. Unfortunately, the laws aimed at helping homeowners avert preventable foreclosures through either loss mitigation or loan modification have not had the intended effect. After passage of Senate Bill 628, our organization partnered with other homeowner advocates, housing counselors, and consumer attorneys to devise a strategy for outreach and monitoring. We called thousands of homeowners in foreclosure in an effort to educate them and find out if the law was working. And in sum, the answer was unilaterally no, it was not working for them. Why? One of the more common responses was that homeowners were simply unaware that the law existed. When they received the notice of sale, the two pieces of paper alerting them to their rights got lost in the mix, or was structured in such a way that they didn't understand it applied to them. Another problem we've already heard about is the running of the foreclosure time clock while the homeowner believes they are in negotiations for a loan modification. Senate Bill 827A would propose to address those problems with a few simple additions. First off, it would amend and standardize the content of those loan modification request forms. Again, when a homeowner right now receives a notice of sale, there are two pieces of paper in that very large stack that pertain to their right to request a loan modification meeting and review. One of the difficulties is that these papers are not standardized, so as housing counselors and advocates, they don't always know what that loan modification reform request form looks like, and it's not as clearly worded as would be helpful for homeowners. So this would amend and standardize those forms. Number two, increase transparency. I think a key part of this is requiring a copy of the lender affidavit to be sent to the Department of Justice and allowing the homeowner to elect to file a declaration in their county recorder's office, thus creating a public record that they have requested the review. Stopping the dual track, again, we've already heard about this. This creates a pause button in the middle of the foreclosure process. About 80 days into the foreclosure, you must start the publication phase. What 827A says is that a lender or their agent could not start that publication phase, which runs four consecutive weeks, if they have not finalized the negotiations with the homeowner on their request for a loan modification. this is going to create the kind of time a homeowner needs. If the answer is no, this at least gives them 40 days to come up with an alternate plan. At this point, we run into too many homeowners who have a few days to scramble to either correct errors or come up with an alternate plan. And then finally, the accountability piece, clarifying that violations would be a violation of our state consumer protection law. The UTPA is a very important component of this. Again, as we've heard, we're a non-judicial foreclosure state, so this gives the homeowners an opportunity to go before a judge if they feel that the process has been violated. There are many conversations happening at the federal level on this topic. I submitted a letter regarding the consent orders showing that national and state consumer advocates do not feel that the current proposals have gone far enough to solve the problem, and I'm confident that Senate Bill 827 is something that if you decide you could put into place and it would not conflict with any changes that we see happening at the federal level. Again, I thank you for your time and welcome any questions you might have.
Okay, I think we'll go ahead and hear from both of you and then open it up for questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Collette. I'm from Bend, Oregon. I'm actually born and raised here. I've been a contractor for 38 years. Started in Salem and been in Bend for 21 years. Always been busy, always been considered very good at what I do. Worked hard, paid my bills, didn't have a lot of credit out there. When I bought the house that's now being foreclosed, I didn't owe money on anything except that house. I sold two other properties to get into that house, so I put a lot of money down. I didn't just barely get into it, and I made the payments easily. The last 3 years have been the most frustrating in my life. I've been through three different modification tries, and the first two, when they said no, I didn't even know why. And they changed the criteria. They lost paperwork. I sent it back again. By the time I sent it back again, they said, well, now it's been too long. We need an update. I've sent so much paperwork to them. And just one time that I did a tried for a loan, the paperwork was 2.5 inches thick. I measured it. All for nothing. During this time, I've drained my retirement, my savings, my emergency fund, everything. And I didn't stop making my payments. I made my payments until they refused to take them. And they did that on three different occasions, but they reported to the credit agencies that I was delinquent. I used to have an 810 credit rating, and now it's somewhere swirling along the bottom of the toilet. So not only do I have to start over, I have a terrible credit rating right now. And I don't mind starting over. I can do that. And when you're in business and you make mistakes, you have to take those. I don't believe I did that. I paid my bills. I worked hard. I saved. I put a lot down on the house. And now it is virtually all gone. And at 59, not many people want to hire you. I've been out of work for 3 years. And I'm not the only one. There's many people out there, thousands of us, hundreds of thousands of us with the similar stories. So I'm not a flake. I pay my bills. Like I said, I owed nobody money except for my house. I didn't have credit card debt and truck payments and everything else. Everything was paid for. So it's frustrating for me to see this continue to go on, and somehow the banks are the only ones who are making money. They got bonuses when they were making the loans. They got bonuses when they got money from the government that were supposed to help us. And we don't seem to be, you get the feeling when you're one of us that there's nothing you can do. The only reason I'm in my house now is a lady introduced herself to me last time I was here. And she's been able to postpone my sale three different times because of things that they're doing wrong. I'm lucky in that aspect because a lot of people, they don't think there's anything they can do, and they just walk away from their houses. And there's probably things that banks and the law firms who are filing the lawsuits are doing wrong. So we as citizens of this state and this nation need help from people like you to pass laws like this. That we've got to start somewhere. To say this, enough's enough. They can't just, it's like the rules don't apply to them. We try to live by them, but it seems like they don't. and we need to start somewhere and say, enough's enough. We're going to start making some changes, and I'd like your support on this bill a bit, where we can start to move forward and maybe get some help for some of us.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions? Okay, thank you very much, both of you, for being here. And I'm going to call several people at a time because we do have a lot of witnesses. I'll call David Jones, Connie Umpness, and John Polanski, if you'd like to all come forward together. We have three chairs here. And I am going to ask you, I won't time you, but I'm going to ask you to try to be, to tell your story, but not to go on too long because we do have a lot of people to testify. So whichever of you would like to go first, please go ahead.
My name is David Jones. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I want to just say that the gentleman that just spoke pretty much said everything that I could possibly say. However, I have a different situation. I tried for about 2 years to get a modification out of the Bank of America, and I used the Home Affordable Program, the federal program at one time, and I submitted all the paperwork too. It was lost, like you said, they couldn't find it. Eventually, after about a year, I was denied. I tried again to get a modification, and it was denied by another agency. Then I heard about the Oregon Homeowner Stabilization Program, the lottery program that would pay your mortgage for 1 year if you were behind. I was accepted into the lottery. I wanted to say thank you for submitting your application for home ownership stabilization. Out of the 15,000 Oregonians who have applied for assistance, your application will now go to our final review process. And I got that letter back in February of this year. They've been working on getting my loan modified with Bank of America. Bank of America called me at the moment that I got this letter and said, we want to offer you a modification. They sent me the documentation. I sent it back. Then they agreed to give me the modification. Then I sent it back in. They rushed me a FedEx with the modification. It was a pretty good modification, but I still would be underwater. But I thought, well, what the heck? I gotta take it because I had a 5-year ARM. This would give me a 30-year. But when I sent it back, they said they received it a day late, so they denied the modification. In the interim period, I've been asked for my taxes 3 times. I'm a small business owner. I lost a contract here with the state of Oregon this year. So I haven't had much money lately. I also do some international work. And I feel like, you know, with everything that I've done in my life, I also have a PhD. I don't look like it. I'm broke, and who knows what's going to happen next. That everything I've done here, it seems like it's to no avail. We have a disparate system of power between the consumer, the homeowner, and the bank. And we can't negotiate with them. I'm also a mediator. There's no mediation with Bank of America. They give you the terms, you either can meet them or you can't. If they are disingenuous in the negotiation process, you're at a loss. There's nothing you can do. I feel like what the gentleman said, there needs to be some consumer safeguards put in place to help homeowners. I'm probably not the not the only one. I just got this call yesterday to show up, but I would hope that this committee would find upon itself to help struggling homeowners in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. I heard from you already.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. Nearly 10 years ago, my husband and I bought our modest...
Can you just say your name?
I'm Connie Umpress from Portland. Nearly 10 years ago, my husband and I bought our modest home in North Portland. A weak job market, the births of our 2 children, and sustained underemployment led to a particularly tight financial space. In December of 2009, my husband contacted Wells Fargo in an attempt to negotiate late fees on the first month we would have ever been significantly late on our mortgage. The customer service representative suggested a pre-approved mortgage modification. We accepted and were instructed to not pay our next month's mortgage and pay a reduced amount for 3 months. We were told we would receive paperwork to get us started in the modification process. It was presented as an easy process with little to lose. We were excited we had been presented a solution that could help us reduce our bills and help us through this hard time. Each month, we would get our bill showing back payment owed and late fees accrued. The daily collection calls started up to 8 a day. Each representative had a different story with what paperwork we needed and how we were supposed to be moving forward in the process. We finally got our official modification paperwork in June. By then, the financial ramifications of 6 months' worth of their instructions were adding up quickly, as were the health effects of the tremendous stress placed upon our family. June, July, and August were filled with gathering together the necessary paperwork, faxing, regathering, refaxing, and waiting. We were assured repeatedly that things were moving along, and we did not have long to wait. Then came the foreclosure paperwork. In more calls to Wells Fargo, the representatives told us that it was nothing to worry about. It was all part of the process. In August, we were given a representative that would help us finish our modification, and they would be our sole contact for the duration. That contact switched 4 times in 1 month. 9 months from the initial phone conversation that introduced us to the modification process, we were told that we were in the final stages and that everything looked good. We were also receiving information from the trustee company warning us of the impending foreclosure and auction of our home that was scheduled for January 21st of 2011. The 2 weeks they were told us we had to wait turned into 3, then 4, then without any warning, we received a letter denying our modification. At that point, we owed over $12,000 due solely to the instructions that they gave us. We were without hope. We were going to lose our first home and become homeless with 2 children under the age of 4. When I shared my fears with my colleagues at work, they provided me with information that ended up being instrumental in turning my story around. I took that information, started writing letters and making phone calls. The first time I shared my story was with ProPublica, an investigative journalism group that gives responders the opportunity to speak to journalists to share their story. The second call was to Economic Fairness Oregon. Angela Martin and the staff at EFO got us started by helping us wade through the paperwork and find a crucial piece that we had overlooked, which had a deadline that was fast approaching. The next week, I was contacted by ProPublica with the opportunity to speak to a producer at Oprah. While going forward with the prescribed steps to avoid the foreclosure with guidance from EFO, we also spoke with the producer. We ended up receiving national media attention that was key to getting the vice president level attention from Wells Fargo. They were interested in resolving our situation as soon as possible. Within a month of sharing my story with ProPublica and EFO, our foreclosure was reversed, and we were given the chance to work with Wells Fargo in an attempt to keep our home. Few people facing this situation have been as lucky as we have been. Without the media attention, I'm sure we would have lost our home, as thousands of Oregonians have. I urge you to pass 827A, reforming the mortgage modification process. Without protection from the banks and their convoluted processes, more and more Oregonians will lose their homes. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Polanski, and I am a foreclosure mitigation counselor. I have over 20 years of residential lending experience gained during the 1980s and 1990s when loan approvals had to make sense. I took a 10-year hiatus from the industry before joining Community Housing Services, which is a HUD-approved housing counseling agency and part of the Community Services Consortium that serves Lynn, Lincoln, and Benton counties. I have been providing free foreclosure mitigation counseling services to the public for the last 22 months. I'm here to educate, not to lobby. I will say that the stories I've heard up till now are all true. I've been involved in situations like this consistently. Federal programs to assist homeowners are voluntary and thus commonly known to be ineffective. Enhancements to the Making Home Affordable program, which is offered by the federal government, often exclude loans owned or guaranteed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. That said, over 80% of my clients' loans are owned or guaranteed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. A significant percentage of homeowners with loans who are not owned or guaranteed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac have mortgage servicers who are not participating in the federal program anyways. The ineffectiveness of making home affordable should not be a surprise at this point. I'm sorry, I got a little confused here, but I'd like to provide you with an example. Yesterday, I received a Making Home Affordable Program update titled Supplemental Directive 11-04, Single Point of Contact for Borrower. It basically said the loan servicers are to assign borrowers a relationship manager to serve as the borrower's single point of contact through the entire delinquency or imminent default resolution process. My satisfaction was short-lived when I went on to read that this directive does not apply to loans that are owned or guaranteed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. This enhancement will not help many of my clients. I would now like to state my experience with Oregon Senate Bill 628, which was passed in 2009 to give homeowners facing foreclosure the opportunity to request a loan modification meeting with a representative of the mortgage servicer who has the authority to make a loan modification decision. It has been my experience that Senate Bill 628 is either ignored by the mortgage servicers or only complied with in a very limited way. Servicer compliance is very difficult to detect. I will say it is highly unusual to ever speak with anyone who has the authority to modify a mortgage loan. Loan negotiators are the people we get to talk to, but the title really doesn't say what they do. They do not negotiate. Loan negotiators send recommendations to loan underwriters who usually need more information, and there's a lot of time wasted, and then they submit the modification request to an investor behind the scenes for approval or rejection. This process takes many months and contributes to the cost of the monetary solution. Also, housing counselors like me are at a loss as how to enforce Senate Bill 628. My last topic is the dual track program. By the time the homeowner finds out they are declined for their modification request, there's not enough time to try another workout option or to sell the property in advance of the foreclosure sale date. I mean, we have clients who actually have equity in their house, and they're in the same position as somebody with no equity. When do they start trying to sell the property? The system does not allow a homeowner to request both a modification and a short sale at the same time, even if the homeowner would be satisfied by either solution. Most homeowners prefer to keep their home if they can be approved for a loan modification, so they do not try to sell the property. Housing counselors are often in the dark as to whether the investor will be willing to work with the homeowner, so in many cases we cannot tell the homeowner whether to first start with the modification or to go right to the sale approach. It will keep the cost of the solution down if the foreclosure action is not started while the modification or short sale solution is being considered. The cost of publication of the default notice tends to cost the homeowner over $2,000. So when this foreclosure starts, when the notice is sent and it has to be publicized, there's an automatic cost of over $2,000 for posting it in the newspapers. This is in addition to other costs associated with the foreclosure proceeding. These costs are not forgiven in a modification workout. They're usually added to the principal balance of the loan. I hope I have adequately explained why the state of Oregon must act to better protect homeowners facing foreclosure. The federal government is not doing so. This concludes my testimony. Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, I thank you for letting me present my experience as a foreclosure mitigation counselor to you today.
Thank you, all three of you, for your stories and your testimony. And it looks like you had written testimony, and if you did not. You were just looking at notes. Okay, thank you very much. And Senator Farioli, you have
a question. Madam Chair, for Mr. Polyansky. I was interested in a comment that you made as in describing your experience as a loan underwriter.
I wasn't an underwriter.
Okay, well, you must have at one point in time had an opportunity to do loan approvals, because you said you worked in the lending industry when loan approvals made sense.
Right. Or yeah. I was the vice president of a Ferry Fine Savings and Loan Association.
Can you expand on what your meaning is? What did you mean when you said that at a time when loan approvals had to make sense,
okay,
as opposed to today?
Well, the problem we're having today, there's many facets to it. We have people who are losing their homes because they lost their jobs. We have people who are losing their homes because they're ill and they don't have health insurance, okay? But we also have people who are losing their homes because they were encouraged to refinance their homes and take equity out. My oldest customer, believe it or not, is 90 years old. I have another customer who's 87 years old. These are people who should own their homes free and clear. My customer, who's 87 years old, bought her house in 1962 for $5,000. Okay? She now owes in the neighborhood of $200,000. People were often encouraged to refinance the loans, to take home equity loans. A lot of people that we come in contact with, they just don't have a first mortgage. They have a second mortgage. The second mortgage might have been from 100% financing, that 80-20 financing that they were encouraged to take when they bought a home that was too expensive for them. Or the second mortgage came out later, when the financial institutions were encouraging people to tap into their equity. So when I was a lender, I often had to tell people that we could not approve a loan for them at this time, that our bank was not in the position where we wanted to take back homes. It wasn't good for us. It wasn't good for the homeowner. You know, we would either encourage them to buy a less expensive home or to come back to us at a later date when they had more income. But we lent money. I worked for a savings and loan, and when we lent the money, we felt we were lending our bank's money. Yes, we did sell a portion of our portfolios, but we always treated it as if it was all our loan, all our money. We knew the depositors who were putting the money in the bank that we were lending out. The people today who were making these loans, they had no idea where the money was coming from, and it was coming from all over the world. And today, when we have to go back and say, who's the investor, we have no idea who the investors are behind these loans, and it's almost comical when they say it's subject to investor approval. If I was an investor, I would be very unhappy today that a loan that I have outstanding is not quickly being resolved, and the problem, by the time it's settled, is much bigger than when it started.
And Chair Fowler?
Yes, briefly.
Mr. Polansky, did you ever try to get ahead of that curve and determine who it was that was buying the bundled and the packaged loans, the investor?
When I started, we were selling, when I started in residential lending in 1978, my savings and loan was, we were selling through probably Fannie and Freddie, but we were also selling direct to other banks. I was in Florida. We would sell to banks in Iowa, farm-rich towns who had a lot of cash and they wanted to invest in mortgages. They'd come down and see the properties. I would have to show them, 10 or 15 properties in a day, so they knew what they were buying, so they could double check the portfolio. We weren't giving them the lots on the railroad tracks, okay? But they got away from all that. Nobody cared. They were getting commissions and bonuses. I hope that answers your question.
Well, it does, Madam Chair, but I guess for me, I've tried to follow the thread also, and what I find is, first, the thing that you learn is that the mortgage lending industry can't survive without the secondary mortgage market purchasing those loans. So it's routine for virtually every mortgage lender to bundle,
right,
and sell the securities.
It makes sense.
And the people ending up buying these things aren't faceless corporations. Sometimes they're small investors. I've seen one thread that goes into a small village in Belgium, who bought American-backed securities because they knew they were the safest securities in the world. That was before the crash. I don't know what they think is the safest security in the world today. Madam Chairman, I'm sure we could have a long colloquy about this. I'm interested in getting a copy of your written testimony because, finally, it sounds like Mr. Polansky listed more than a dozen specific issues that need to be addressed, sort of on a macro scale. In your opinion, Mr. Polansky, Madam Chairman, does 827 deal with the issues that you raised?
I work for a nonprofit, and I'm not allowed to lobby for a bill in my capacity. But it certainly addresses some of the points, the dual track. That's very difficult for a homeowner. You're trying to get a modification, and in the meanwhile, the foreclosure sale date is ticking away. It's very difficult to communicate with the mortgage servicer to reach someone in authority. You're calling a call center, and they really don't have the ability at the last minute to put off a sale. I'm often faced with contacting the controller of the currency. Some people say to me, is that something in the United States? And it sounds British, but yes, we have a controller of the currency, and I can't tell you how many times they've helped. Okay, I can tell you that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are totally ineffective and contribute greatly to the problems we have today. They contributed to the beginning of the problem, and they're contributing to there being no solution.
And thank you for your comments. And certainly you're right. We could talk way beyond the scope of the bill if we had the time to do so. But we don't. I just want to clarify one more thing, that Mr. Polansky did get a request from the chair to appear today and has signed up as a neutral on this bill. He's providing informational testimony.
Okay.
So,
Madam Chair, it appears that the bill requires some filings of and recording of forms. And I just wondered if the required forms, the filing of the forms, the execution of the forms, and the recording of the forms addresses the issues that you brought forward today, which are significant.
This requirement evidently started recently, and as housing counselors and the mortgage, the people with mortgages, it's really been invisible to us. There has not been a lot of compliance with all of this. And when you call into the mortgage servicers, they don't know what this is. They don't even know what the state of Oregon's mortgage payment assistance program is. These mortgage servicers, they have more employees than some governments have employees.
Yeah. Thank you, Minister.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Thank you all three for being here. Next, I'll call Paul Cosgrove and Drew Hagedorn. Would both like to come forward together?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. Paul Cosgrove representing the members of the United Financial Lobby, which are the banks, credit unions, and other mortgage lenders operating in Oregon. I'd like to start. I actually have six or seven specific problems or concerns to raise about the bill, but I'd like to start with two general issues that I think have been raised by prior testimony that I'd like to lay out. First of all, there's been discussion about loan approval being more precise in the past. The reason I think that's a relevant comment, particularly relevant comment to this debate, is if you think what's happening in a loan modification, effectively it is a loan approval. And one of the reasons that the loan modification process with every lender who is doing their job at this point is complicated and detailed is that, in fact, it is effectively another loan approval. It's an evaluation of whether the property is worth more or less than the current loan balance. It's an evaluation of whether the borrower continues to have the income to support the loan and whether there's any combination of changes that would change that factor and allow the person to stay. So that's one of the reasons modification isn't a very simple or straightforward process. It's effectively new loan approval. The second thing I'd like to point out is the dual track issue. You've heard about how that is confusing. Senate Bill 628, which we negotiated with folks a couple of years ago, only applies when there is a dual track. In other words, Senate Bill 628 only deals with modifications and the modification negotiations that happen after a foreclosure has been initiated. And Senate Bill 827 also only applies when there is a dual track going on. It only applies to cases in which the foreclosure has already started. We don't have law. I'm not sure we can even create law that would deal with modifications prior to that time. And as I testified a couple of years ago when Senate Bill 628 was negotiated and adopted, most modifications in my experience and in my members' experience do not occur because of something that goes out with the initial foreclosure notice, which is what Senate Bill 628 a couple of years ago provided and what Senate Bill 827 now provides or would provide. They happen as we get close to the sale. They happen when people get serious and recognize that they need to start talking together and working out problems. These bills only address a small slice of the negotiations and the history of a loan, and they can't, therefore, solve all of the problems. The six specific points, and I'll make them briefly. I'm happy to provide additional detail on any of them if you so choose. This bill will delay foreclosures and increase costs for both people who go into successful modifications and, if not, for the lenders if there is a failure of a modification and the foreclosure goes forward. The delay happens because of the provisions for waiting 45 days on page 6. Number 2, this bill provides for a process that adds a cloud to the title of any loan in foreclosure without a process to remove that cloud on the title, and that's because of the provisions that occur on pages 6 and 7 about the recording of an affidavit. Title companies, I know because I've talked to them, are concerned about how this would affect title. The third point is there are several provisions here that are very unclear in terms of what they mean, and it's partly because language is picked up that may mean certain things to certain kinds of lenders but are not defined terms, and I'll point out just two of them. On page 4 in lines 9 and 10, there's discussion about a different loan modification program. As if there is a different loan modification program in existence. There aren't just cookie-cutter programs. Every lender has different programs. And the second thing is on page 6. mitigate loan losses on page 30, or line 37. I don't think we know what mitigate loan losses mean. So I think there's a number of provisions that would have to be clarified before this could become workable. The third thing is this will increase litigation in this area that is already fraught with a lot of litigation. A number of provisions which are now remedied by, if there's a failure to follow the provisions in our foreclosure statutes, it means the foreclosure is not effective as to the parties against whom the provisions were beneficial. We would now also add litigation under Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and those are provisions in pages 4, 5, and 6 with respect to three different aspects or failures of to provide notice. Another issue, I think it's relatively minor in one sense, but I think it is a significant problem in the bill. The provisions of Section 4 with respect to who a trustee can be, I'm quite certain they're unconstitutional. We had provisions like this that said lawyers could not be licensed in another state unless they lived there. The U.S. Supreme Court provided that was unconstitutional. I think the same thing happens if you try to make trustees residents of this state rather than residents of some other state operating in this state. The current law provisions provide that the trustee must be someone for whom a borrower or any other party can locate them in this state. They must be either licensed by this state or be an attorney licensed by the state or a banker or a title company, but that you cannot make them, I believe, constitutionally limit them to residents of this state. The other thing I'd like to point out quickly is there are two specific rulemakings. You heard Senator Bonamici talk about standardized forms. DCBS is required to put together standardized forms for loan modifications and for affidavits to say what happened during the loan modification process. As I just mentioned, a modification essentially is a loan approval. I don't know how DCBS will put together a standardized form that will be useful and meaningful to every kind of lender, from the small credit union to the big bank, giving them the kind of information they need to know about whether the loan can be modified. And at the very least, you would certainly expect that there would be a fiscal impact from those rulemakings that are required by the bill. And then lastly, you've heard about, in Ms. Martin's testimony, the foreclosure crisis. And that reflects that we are in a stage like very much like we had in the early 80s when I first started to practice law, where home prices and job opportunities and all sorts of other economic conditions were such that we had a huge spike in foreclosures. That's where we are now. Senate Bill 628 had a sunset. Senate Bill 827 eliminates it, and I don't think these provisions are appropriate in Senate Bill 628, nor in this bill, except in these unusual times, and it would be inappropriate to eliminate the sunset. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks.
And thank you for your time.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, committee members. Drew Hagedorn appearing today on behalf of the United Trustees Association, testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 827 as it's currently composed. Mr. Cosgrove, I think, raised most of the concerns that we have, most prominently his point number 5 concerning non-resident trustees. We share his concern about the constitutionality of that issue and would suggest some changes there, particularly at ORS 60.112C. You could include non-resident trustees by incorporating that provision and allowing a non-resident trustee to have an office for service here in Oregon State. Secondly, we object to making a UTPA violation, an unlawful Trade Practices Act violation, for some unintentional, perhaps a Scrivener's error, for example, non-material errors in the foreclosure process. That seems unduly harsh from our perspective, so we object to those provisions. And then finally, one point that Mr. Carvago didn't raise is that at Section 35A, the legislation requires a compliance affidavit being sent to the Department of Justice, but doesn't require the DOJ to do anything with that once they receive it. We feel that's an extraneous requirement or mandate on trustees and was just striking that provision. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. And I just wanted to ask you, my reading of the language in Section 4 and page 7 of the bill is that the requirement is either that the trustee be a resident of the state or have a registered agent. So it doesn't say that the trustee themselves has to be living in Oregon. Are you reading that differently?
Madam Chair, I am, because the trustee can be an individual, and the registered agent concept, generally speaking, if not exclusively, only applies to corporate entities who have registered agents with the Secretary of State. So I think it does mean that an individual who otherwise fit the current statutory requirements would have to be, if these were adopted, a resident of the state of Oregon. I think that's the constitutional problem.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, I don't see any. Thank you both.
Thank you
very much for your testimony. Next, I'll call, looks like 4 more people signed up to testify. I'll call Valerie Arthurs, Sybil Hebb, John Bartholomew, and Keith Jabanovich. We won't have chairs unless we pull up a 4th one, but we would like to complete the testimony, so why don't you all come forward. Great. We do have 4 chairs. Magic. Okay, and we're getting a little short on time, so we'll ask you to give your testimony, but if you could summarize it, that would be super.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here. I'll be brief in support of Senate Bills 827A. I also have handed in some written testimony and testimony from NEDCO, which is the housing counselor organization in Lane County. And from the Law Center's perspective, this is a concerning issue with respect to the impact that it has on homeowners who are struggling and also on the communities surrounding those homeowners. And we recognize that there are many foreclosures that are unavoidable and that need to be processed and finalized, however unfortunate. But there are a significant number of foreclosures which we feel are avoidable, and the problem becomes, or one of the problems that we see primarily, is that the process of processing these foreclosures it's a sort of a morass, and it continues almost of its own gravitational force. And it's important to provide a space where we just put a pause in the process to make sure that there's an actual interaction between the homeowner and the processors, the lenders, to take a look and see, is there another option? Is there a way that we can find to provide a modification that makes sense for both of us? The bill wouldn't require modifications. It doesn't determine what the terms would be that the parties could use to consider that. It just puts a process into place by which there can be a little pause button to make sure that people take a look at those circumstances and see whether there's another way. And we think that's helpful both for individuals as well as for communities, and the pause that it puts into place with respect to the dual track situation is important as well. And we have had many clients who we know have been working with housing counselors and trying to go through the process of modification only to find that their foreclosure has actually gone through is on the cusp of going through. And that's not anyone's understanding when they get into the modification process, and it's also a significant waste of time for both the nonprofits as well as individuals and the lenders to sort of be looking at this modification and devoting resources to that, but not actually giving that a chance to be successful. And so we like the process that 628 set up and the goals that it was intended to accomplish. We think that this bill will help improve that process and make it more likely to be effective both for lenders and for homeowners. And so we really appreciate the attention that everyone has put into this issue and think this is a good step forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, my name is Valerie Arthurs, and I'm a homeowner. After 2.5 years of talking to the bank, and my story is kind of the same as what I've heard from other people here today, the mountain of paperwork, the lost paperwork, the constant filling out of the packets. But after 2.5 years, I finally did get a modification in September of 2010. Everything was fine. I thought, okay, we can finally breathe. You know, we can relax. In January of this year, I get a denial. And I'm thinking, why do I get a denial on my modification? I've been current. I've set it up that the bank takes it out of the bank automatically. I did nothing wrong, but I'm looking at this denial. And so after you call the bank and they don't know what you're talking about, they give you a customer representative and they say, well, you talk to us and, you know, we'll be there for you. We'll try to get this straightened out. We'll get back to you. They don't. You call them. You ask for that person. They say, oh, you've been transferred to somebody else now. This is your customer representative. This is just like I dealt with before. Monday, I get another packet in the mail. Congratulations, you have been granted a modification. And I'm thinking, I got one in September. Why do I have another one? It just seems like the bank doesn't know what they're doing. They're holding your life in their hands, and they can just give you a notice or a phone call whenever they want to. It doesn't seem like it ever gets over. That's all.
Thank you very much. I know it's hard to tell these stories. It's
it is.
Hard thing, an even harder thing to go through. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. No, I'm fine. I'm just, this is nervous.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Keith Dubanovich. I'm Chief of Staff at the Oregon Department of Justice. As indicated in my written testimony, we have received a very large volume of complaints specifically relating to loan modification problems. Indeed, over 400 just in calendar year 2010. These complaints are very similar to what you've heard so far today, and that is people who have repeatedly submitted the exact same information to the exact same bank address, and it continues to get lost and continues to get lost. Delays that seem to go on forever, and people feeling like they don't know whether they're going to be allowed to stay in their home, and ambiguity about whether they qualify for a loan modification or don't. And as you just heard, some people are told that they qualify for a loan modification, and then a short period of time later, a foreclosure notice is sent to their home. We hear a lot of people who are told to stop paying on their loan so that they would then qualify for a loan modification. But that is not necessarily good advice, because they may very well have been able to remain current on the loan but for the advice that they should stop paying. But of course, once they stop paying, they're in default, their credit gets hurt, and they start the slippery slope of going toward foreclosure. Unfortunately, we've heard of people who have complied with the terms of their loan modification, and that includes a reduced payment. But even though they're in full compliance with a loan modification, they're sent a foreclosure notice. The normal process that our office takes is that when we receive a complaint such as some of these that you've heard today, we immediately try to contact the bank, and many times we're able to work with the bank and the homeowner and avoid foreclosure. Oftentimes, it's the failure of communication between the bank and the homeowner that causes the problem. And this particular bill that's before you today aids in requiring communication between the homeowner and the bank, providing specific timelines and some guidance for the homeowner. One of the common problems that we hear is that there's a federal program called HAMP, or Making Home Affordable. Unfortunately, there is no federal enforcement of that program, and so we often are called upon to do something. But we don't have enforcement power over a federal act either. So what happens is that there's lack of compliance with both the state act and the federal act, and there's no enforcement of either statute. This bill provides the enforcement for the law that you folks passed two sessions ago, and that law is still in effect and is a good law, because what it does is it requires proper notice to the homeowner so that the homeowner can ask for a loan modification. It's not going to change who qualifies for a home modification. It just simply allows them to ask for one on a timely basis. Last but not least, what the bill also does is change the time period when the servicer files an affidavit that says that the homeowner is not qualified for a loan modification. It extends that period of time prior to the sale date for a simple reason that we found in a number of circumstances. By the time the homeowner gets the affidavit and reads the affidavit and recognizes that the affidavit is frankly false, it's too late. Their home has already gone into foreclosure, and they can't challenge the affidavit. So the purpose of changing the timelines here is to allow the homeowner to get the affidavit, and if they believe the affidavit is false, they can file their own declaration that challenges the declaration filed by the servicer so that the foreclosure essentially is put on hold. Thank you. Happy to answer questions.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm a policy advocate with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. And I'll be very brief because so much has already been said today, but we're in full support of Senate Bill 827A. Let me just tell a short story about the impact of the dual-track issue that you've heard about today. I heard recently from a homeowner who her situation is got behind on their mortgage because of a car accident that her husband was in, caused a number of medical bills that got them behind while he wasn't working. And while they got that all worked out, they ended up paying that off. It set them behind on their mortgage. He retired. She was still working. Started working with their lender for a loan modification. Well, they were approved for a trial modification, and under the rules of the program, you pay your amount for 3 months, and if you provide all the documentation, you will be approved for a permanent modification. So they did that, and they had made their third and final payment, and then they received notice that they were being foreclosed on in a week. The whole foreclosure process was still going on as they were doing this and as they fulfilled all their responsibilities, except then they said, the bank said that we didn't get all the information from you. It's something we have heard from homeowner after homeowner after homeowner. We haven't received it. We've lost the information, etc. This family was lucky. They were lucky because since he was retired, he had the time to wait on the phone for hours and hours and hours, getting bounced around from public, from customer service person to customer service person, finally got an answer as to what it was that they wanted. It was about income verification. They had provided pay stubs, Social Security stubs, tax records, etc., several different kinds of information. What the bank had never told them specifically they wanted until they finally met this, reached this one customer service agent, is a letter from the Social Security agency saying that he was on Social Security. They never said that they wanted that until they spent hours on the phone trying to get that. Once they were able to get that, everything became okay again. They were able to get their permanent modification. The foreclosure was stopped. But if he didn't have that time, he wouldn't have, that family would be out of their home, lose the equity that they did have, and it would just be bringing down the values of homes all around them. If it was not for the dual track, they would have had much more time.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but if you could kind of summarize and wrap up, we're almost out of time here.
Well, I was just wrapping up. Thank you. Sorry. So the dual track was the issue involved there. If there was no dual track, they would have had plenty of time to work that out. So that's why we're supporting Senate Bill 827. It deals with that issue, and it's a very important issue to deal with. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you all for your testimony. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much for being here today, and that completes our sign-up sheet. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 827A and open a work session on Senate Bill 827A.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Burdick.
I move Senate Bill 827 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick has moved Senate Bill 827A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Members, there is fiscal and revenue impact, no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact. Are all paperwork is in order?
Correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is there discussion on the motion? Senator Farrioli.
Madam Chair, I really appreciate having the testimony that we had from the panel. I have a number of questions that I didn't want to ask because of the lateness of the hour, but the question about what the DCBS form would look like for a variety of lenders, what happens if there's a challenge to the affidavit, how the challenge is resolved. I'd love to have more information about which underwriters use which kind of a checklist. You know, is there a standard set of information that people doing the underwriting for loan modifications need to have, and how does that information, it seems like it fits like a lock and a key for some people. I'd like to know more about that. I don't know if there's time, you know, with this time frame that we seem to be on today. I'll be voting no on the bill, Madam Chairman, and I will be looking for ways to figure out how to answer some of the questions that were brought up here today.
And Senator Farrioli, appreciate your questions, and certainly I'm sure people can attempt to get answers to them for you. Further discussion on the motion. I would just say that having heard 2 years ago when I was in a committee chaired by Senator Bonamici many similar stories to the ones that we heard today, and then reading recently that we have now got one of the highest rates of foreclosures in the entire nation and unfortunately have 25,000 properties in foreclosure and 3,000 more just last month went into foreclosure, I feel some urgency, not just in terms of the lateness of the session, but also the human and really chaotic situation that people are facing as they move into an economy that's still very challenging and are faced with losing everything. And so I think given the timing of the session, it is, though sometimes hard to get every question answered in the hearing. I think we've had an opportunity to discuss this bill and feel it really is needed. Okay, Mike, would you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator Byer?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferrioli?
No.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. Motion carries.
Madam Chair, I'm inserting notes on the probability of a minority report.
Thank you. So noted. And members, thank you for your patience. With nothing further to come before us today, we are adjourned.